COVID-19 has brought great suffering to the people of Italy. But amidst the anguish and gloom, are there also signs of hope?
The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war.
There's an ancient Chinese expression that says, may you live in interesting times.
Welcome to Coronavirus Lockdown with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Luke Cooper. Today, we take stock of what the global community can learn from the tragic plight of Italy and ask if coronavirus, this huge shock to the global system, will finally force the changes needed to put the continent onto a better course. With a huge economic and public health rescue operation now underway, will the EU break with austerity and reform the troubled Eurozone? In the digital studio today, we're joined by Laura Parker, former national coordinator of Momentum, calling in from the Piedmont region of Italy, not far from the centre of the outbreak in the Lombardy region. Also dialing in, this time from Oxford, is Italian left activist and neuroscientist Andrea Pizzarro. To feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future, please email podcast@anotheryeurope.org.
Italy is now almost in a full lockdown. All non-essential services will be halted.
The entire country has been put into lockdown to stem the spread of COVID-19.
The Prime Minister here has described the situation, quoting Winston Churchill, as Italy's darkest hour.
Hi both, so welcome to the show. Laura, you're in Piedmont at the moment. I mean, God, what must the atmosphere be like in northern Italy right now?
Look, I think it's actually getting increasingly difficult, actually. Paradoxically, I've just seen the numbers at 6:30 every day. I get an email with an update on what's happened. And, you know, it looks like, well, for the last few days, the trend has been reducing. Still a horrendous number of people died yesterday, over 600, 604. Taking the total number of cases to sort of nearly 136,000. But this is less than it was. I mean, last week there were over 900. So, but people are getting weary. I mean, I can really, you know, even the little town I'm in, which is in the Piemonte region, but it's at a distance really from the worst of everything. I live in a rural area up a hill where it's always calm. The supermarket's been brilliantly organised for weeks, but I went today for my kind of, you know, once a week shop, and the woman behind the till is really, really nervous. You're not allowed out now without a face mask on. Yesterday, I went for a walk around the corner from my house, and, I mean, this is literally the middle of nowhere, and I was stopped 3 times in the space of 1 hour by 3 different cars patrolling around from the civil protection service, insisting that I wear a face mask when you could not see another soul in sight. I mean, I don't criticize these people at all. I think they are not at the end of their tether, but it's different to how it was. There's been this big slogan of andrà tutto bene, everything's going to be okay, which the school kids were doing like they are in the UK with rainbows, putting posters on their walls. And I have to say that I think now the sort of almost defiant sense of hope at the start is being replaced by real weariness and a sense of people just digging in. And this is here. So I have no idea what it's like in Bergamo. And speaking to friends in Milan at the weekend, I think people are tense, they are tired. There's a sort of sense of suspicion. It's now 6 for many people here. So people are tired.
Yeah, absolutely. And Milan is the capital of Lombardy, right? And that was the real epicenter of the outbreak in Italy, that's right?
Yeah, Milan and the town called Bergamo, which lots of people will know because it's the cheap airport. So if you get sort of, you know, Ryanair, well, when you used to get Ryanair, it would take you to Bergamo, which is 40 kilometres or something out of the centre of Milan. That's where the epicenter has been. Then there's Piemonte region and also Veneto. It looks like things have sort of more under control in other parts of Italy. There had been real concern at one point that there'd be a massive surge of cases in the south. Andrea can probably say better than me what that's looking like now. But people are starting to talk about when the shutdown might end, but it's not with any sense of immediacy.
Andrea, it was a month ago now, the 9th of March, where Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced the countrywide shutdown. But as Laura just said, of course, parts of northern Italy had essentially already been in lockdown, so it's been going on even longer. What was it like following these events from the UK? I know that you're an intensely engaged political activist on a pan-European level, but you obviously follow the situation in your own country extremely closely.
I've been following since the beginning of the onset of the epidemics in Italy, partly because I obviously follow what's the situation in the country where I was born, and I have a lot of friends that were in the area in the north, all the Lombardy region. It's a very interconnected area where a lot of people travel every day, and I know a lot of these people, and they were posting on Facebook, on social media, and exchanging messages about how bad was the situation. But in a way, it was also my network of scientific friends and colleagues that was very alert, because immediately when the first cases were recorded in this little comune called Codogno, there has been an intense effort of the scientific community in Italy to analyze the pattern of data and to come up with an understanding of how bad was the situation there. So in a way, when the country was locked down, I was not particularly shocked, because I've been following the head of the Accademia dei Lincei, which is the main scientific body in Italy, who was posting articles saying this is really bad, we need to lock down the country as soon as possible. Then, of course, there was also my father that was calling me. Instead of that once a week, it turned to every day. So there was this sense of alarm from the country, from my own family and friends, which were concerned. I have to say, though, that my family is in Rome, and throughout the crisis in Rome, there have been less cases than in London. When Lombardy was locked down, and 2 days later, Roma was locked down, London was still open, and there were more cases in London than in Rome.
Good evening. Three young doctors working in the A&E department of a London hospital have issued a stark warning to Britain. The doctors warned that they are seeing people in their 20s and 30s who are very sick, and they said that the surge of cases was only just beginning.
I felt compelled to raise the alarm here as much as I could, talking to people, posting on social media, because it was clear to me that Italy didn't go into lockdown for fun or because they were hysterical, but there was a serious health concern. And the chain of transmission of this virus is such, for which to me it looked inevitable, that it would arrive in the UK in a very similar fashion. So now I am still deeply worried about Italy, but I am equally, if not more, worried about the situation here.
This week we had the shocking news that the Prime Minister Boris Johnson is in intensive care. We're told he's currently stable in hospital, and wish him and all corona victims a speedy recovery. And Laura, how is the Italian media reporting Boris Johnson?
Well, people are obviously shocked. I mean, it was interesting a few weeks ago when I was here, I noticed that the UK wasn't really being reported. I think there was a lot of frustration at what was seen to be a slow UK response, and the UK was sort of three or four or fifth down the news after South Korea, Cubans sending doctors, Venezuelans sending people. For the last couple of days, Boris Johnson has been a headline news item, and I think people really, however critical they've been of the UK, you know, they definitely know how horrible this is. Nobody wants anyone to suffer from it, and I think everybody understands that, you know, if he's seriously ill, that's going to panic a whole country. And if there's one thing that probably people here have learned, it's that, you know, the panicking just doesn't help.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does feel like a huge moment in the development of the global crisis. I noticed it was a breaking news item on the American news networks, for example.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been moved to the intensive care unit after his condition worsened.
This is the first leader to be taken seriously ill with coronavirus, not to fall victim to it in general. But I mean, it's a huge moment in the development of the global pandemic. Is that right, Andrea?
Absolutely. I've been browsing news outlets from several countries in the last couple of days, and Boris Johnson news was everywhere. And of course, there is concerns everywhere. I mean, in the Italian community, which was very angry at the government, now there is a lot of people that are just worried, because of course, if the government is incapacitated, also the response to the crisis is weaker. And we all wish the best to Boris Johnson. I honestly feel some sense of empathy towards him that never particularly felt, and I really hope that I can recover soon.
I don't think any of us have ever agreed with Boris Johnson on anything, but that's not actually the feeling that one gets from it. Isn't really to do with the political response at all. It's that it underlines the seriousness of this pandemic, that it's not just that you can see the statistics on the television news about numbers of people ill and deaths, and every one of those is absolutely a tragedy, but when it's the Prime Minister of your country that's meant to be resolving the entire crisis is suddenly in intensive care. That's a shocking moment for the development of the crisis in general.
I think as well, I mean, I certainly feel like politics has sort of collapsed as a thing, because it's just so, it just feels very meaningless when you're talking about something so existential. How has the UK response compared to the Italian response?
I mean, I travelled between Italy and the UK twice in February, and I was really staggered by the difference. Both times I left Gatwick and it was business as usual. I arrived in Turin, had my temperature taken, people were wearing gloves, they were wearing masks. This is February. The final time when I came over, I actually had to fly to France in order to get back to our house in Italy, which is my home, by the way. Don't make it sound like I've sort of escaped to some holiday villa. This is where my husband and my family live. But the last time I came here, I had to travel by the south of France because the Italian airport was shut. And again, Gatwick was just normal Gatwick. People handle your passport at the gate, at which point they give it back to you. I mean, I had gloves on because I'd already been through a couple of times. But, you know, there's nowhere at that point to wash your hands. There's this famous wash your hands thing. I mean, when you got to Italy, it was, you know, people who were handling passports were doing it with gloves on. They had face masks on. When I went through the French train station, there was a massive big sort of postbox size public dispenser of hand gel. There was nothing in the UK. And it's a very simple, slightly banal example, but it was staggering me as a non-scientist how very different the response was. And actually, I felt that the UK was undermining the Italian effort.
Generally speaking, most Italians, not just yourself, were looking on pretty aghast at what was going on in the UK, right?
Yes, that's correct. The Italian community in the UK was pretty scared about the reaction of the government, because we all looked at what was going on in Italy and we didn't think that the government in Italy was crazy. And so 2 + 2 = 4. If Italy was acting boldly, why wouldn't the government in the UK do the same?
Can you just tell us who the main parties are in Italy and who's in government?
So the last elections were in March 2018. And the government that we have now is a coalition between the sort of Italian Labour Party, the Partito Democratico, the PD, which back in 2018 was on 19%, and the Five Star Movement, which again back in 2018 was on 33%. The main opposition party then as now is the Lega of the infamous Salvini, which in 2018 was on 17%. Nobody really understands now exactly how popular those three parties are. So if the election took place again tomorrow, it would be difficult to know. The European Parliament elections of 2019 were a disaster for the PD, which went down to 18%, and the Lega went up to 34%. But all indications are since that actually the popularity of Conte, at least, who's the Prime Minister, seems to be going up and up and up throughout this crisis. And the Lega's popularity has taken a big, big hit. So the government at the moment is this coalition between the PD and the Five Star. And I think that the sort of PD bit is probably on the rise. Although Conte himself, who's the Prime Minister, was not a political figure. He's a university professor of law, I think. One of these sort of neutral-ish. I mean, obviously he's centre-centre-left. But one of these neutral people that comes into government, really, because the PD and the Five Star between them were not going to agree on anyone from either of their own sides.
I would say that in Italy, the government has become suddenly popular, because it was not a very popular government by any stretch. But the reaction to the crisis from Conte's government has been appreciated widely by the Italian population. Not just people on the left, but also people on the right or in the center of the political spectrum have appreciated the promptness of the reaction of the government, and also the sort of decisiveness. For instance, immediately after the first cases were detected in Codogno, this little town in Lombardy, a red zone of 10 or 11 little comuni was completely locked down. And since then, I think that the government acted before the perception of the people about the gravity of the problem was increased. So the government was effectively ahead of the people, whereas probably in the UK was the opposite. Yes, Salvini is nowhere to be seen, also because the people realize that this is a tragedy. It's a tragedy for a lot of families up and down the countries. Salvini has tried for a couple of days at the beginning of the crisis to attack the government. That didn't work out very well at all for him. Of course, there has been tensions between the central government and the regions in the north, which are governed by the League of Salvini. So particularly the president of the Lombardy region has been acting in a way which has been described as controversial by many people. For instance, one central episode was during the initial lockdown of the northern part of Italy. The government issued a decree to lock down that part of Italy, but there was a leak so that people knew about this decree before it was actually enforced. And a lot of people left to go back to the region in the south of Italy before the law became effective. And it turned out that the leak was produced by the office of the Lombardy president that passed on this information to the New York Times and other media outlets. And so there was a clear responsibility in the way the region handled the emergency, which needs to be certainly discussed when the crisis is over. Because the reason why the virus arrived in the south of Italy was basically these people that traveled the day. It was a major component, at least. We need to keep in mind that Italy is the country in Europe which has it's the second largest number of cases after Spain, but more than half of them are in one single region, and in fact in a few provinces of that region. So we mentioned Bergamo, Lodi, in the region of Milan, most of the cases are there. For instance, that's different from the UK because the cases are more widespread in the UK.
It does seem to have an effect, a crisis this severe, on people's attitude to government. There does seem to be a kind of, you know, a blank check of trust, if you like, just in the immediate face of it. But do you get the sense that's reshaping domestic politics in a more fundamental way?
Because before this, Matteo Salvini was really on the ascendant in Italian politics. As Laura mentioned, he got 34% in the last European elections, didn't he? So all of Europe was looking on ominously at the Italian situation and thinking, you know, the far right seems to be going from strength to strength here. But this crisis seems to have generated a different situation entirely in terms of the support that the government is getting.
Everything has been reset by the coronavirus crisis. In the context of Italian politics, that meant that the momentum of Salvini has completely collapsed. It's fair to say that there were already some difficulties for Salvini because he was in government 1 year ago. He decided during the summer to resign from government because he wanted to trigger a snap election, and he failed to do so. And in fact, there were a few regional elections, one particularly in Emilia-Romagna, which was a major target for the center-right, and Salvini campaigned heavily in Emilia-Romagna. And already then he was struggling and he didn't win that regional election, which would have been a major blow for the left. So, you know, the situation was not entirely with Salvini with full speed towards the government. However, it was very popular. The political context is also linked to what's happening in Europe, and how Conte is handling the European question. There is a lot of support for the way the Conte's government has been doing in the context of the discussion with the other European member states. But, of course, whether or not Salvini will find a role in the future depends on how successful Conte will be in his negotiation with the EU. And I would refrain from celebrating Salvini's disappearance until we have managed to secure a good outcome of the crisis in the EU.
What's Italy asking for?
Well, in short, it's asking for jointly issued debt, the so-called Corona bonds, so Euro bonds, which would be backed by all European countries to fund the rebuilding. So that's the basic request that the Italians have made. Now, so far, there has been some financial support forthcoming, but not in the shape of bonds. And essentially, There's a bit of a north-south standoff, really, with the Dutch and the German governments in particular not yet having given support for these corona bonds, euro bonds.
Is it basically a replay of the Eurozone crisis with, you know, Italy on one side and Germany on the other, or not?
Talking to friends here, I think that's how they're feeling it. It feels like a crisis that Italy has been left to handle, as it was along with Greece, the refugee crisis. Many Italians probably have a lot of sympathy with the notion that the Italian government should, in the long term, and should have indeed for many years, sort of got its house in order. But I think there's anger at the fact that lots of corporations are paying their taxes elsewhere. That was an issue that came up again around after the banking crisis. I think in Piemonte, this has felt very acutely. I mean, if you remember the Ferrero Rocher chocolates of that terrible famous advert in the UK and Nutella, the chocolate paste.
Remember them? I still eat them.
You still eat them, exactly. So, you know, they're made in Alba, which is a place about 20 minutes away from where I'm talking to you from. Those companies are registered in Luxembourg. Intesa San Paolo, which is one of the biggest banks in the country, which was formed through a merger of a very famous Milanese bank and a bank from Turin, is registered in Luxembourg. I mean, the biggest insult, I think, for the people of Turin is that Fiat, which is the symbol of Turin, and in fact, Fiat stands for, you know, the T in Fiat stands for Turin, that's registered and paying all its taxes in the Netherlands. So there's a lot of anger, really. For, I mean, you know, ordinary folk have got enough on their plates. I don't want to suggest there's sort of people just waiting for the lockdown to stop and there'll be riots about this, because lots of people haven't got time or energy or inclination to dig into these things. But I think those who are, you know, reading the news and following what's going on in the EU, there's a lot of anger, but there appears to be very little solidarity. And Conte, in fact, wrote a brilliant letter. I mean, it was both powerful and in some places quite beautiful to the European Commission, basically saying, you know, this is a historic test for the EU, and fail this and, you know, fail to sort out the bonds in haste and repent at your leisure. And I think others have called it an existential potential crisis for the EU if they don't demonstrate more solidarity with Italy. So it does feel like a rerun of 2008, actually.
I agree fundamentally that the tension between the northern and southern European countries is pretty much along the same lines of 2012. But I think also that there is a few differences which are quite substantial. And part of those differences are due to the fact that in these 6 years there has been a shift, at least in progressive parties throughout Europe, in which a more radical position, partly inspired by the Labour Party of Jeremy Corbyn, but partly also coming from the wave of Syriza, and that resulted in the new government in Portugal with Antonio Costa, and in Spain, where we have a progressive government supported by Podemos and the socialists with Sanchez. There has been a growing sense among progressive parties that the austerity policies need to be abandoned. And so that allowed now, with the coronavirus crisis, to form a much stronger coalition of the southern European countries. Because one of the problems we had in 2012 was that there was a lot of division among the Mediterranean countries. In Italy, there was Renzi that refused to side with Tsipras, weakening the Greek position. Right now, there is a front of 9 countries, which comprises all the countries in the Mediterranean, but also Ireland, Belgium, and also significantly Macron, that has shifted his strategy from a strategy of trying to form an alliance with Germany to another one in which he's trying to build bridges with the other Mediterranean countries. So I think there is a much better position to argue for a significant change of economic policies at the EU level. And there is also, quite interestingly, some debate in those northern countries which always opposed financial solidarity. There has been quite a significant debate in the Netherlands and in Germany. There have been quite a few letters written by economists, philosophers, political scientists, all asking the German government and the Dutch government to change their stance, because the reaction to the coronavirus crisis cannot be the reaction of the crisis of debts in 2012. This is a tragedy for the entire continent. They cannot frame it as a problem of lazy Italians and Greeks that don't work enough. It's something that is affecting everyone, everywhere. So the EU needs to step up its response. This is a turning point in European history, in the world history, and therefore also in European history. And the EU needs to do something bold, which is bold not just economically, but also politically.
And do you get the sense that there's a possibility of something bigger coming out of this, some kind of rediscovery of the EU's fundamental purpose of, you know, peace, reconciliation, humans first, universal human rights? Do you get the sense that that kind of conversation is happening?
I do get the sense that this kind of conversation is happening. It's certainly happening in Italy and in other countries which are deeply affected. But I also feel a sense of the fact that we need to catch this chance. And there is a window of opportunity which is not enormous, and the patience of people is going to be quite short if we don't act now. We already see that a lot of people who are starkly pro-European are saying this is now or never. Either the EU shows now that it exists for its citizens, or...
Yes, it could, as Zoe said, be the spur to a rediscovery, or it could be a spur to people saying, okay, it's lost its fundamental way, that's it.
I agree with you. I don't think there's anything particularly romantic or idealistic about it, to be honest. I think it's built in raw pragmatism, given the extraordinary scale that the crisis, not just Italy, is facing, but the whole of Southern Europe are facing, and indeed the world is facing, in this kind of economic depression that we're seeing. And it is, to my mind, very different from 2015, when Greece was isolated. There are 19 Eurozone members, 9 of them are very strongly pro-reform, 6 of them are in the middle, but leaning towards the pro-reform side, and that only leads 4 countries, led by Germany and the Netherlands, who are really holding out. But even within those countries, the Dutch Labour Party, very clear, said that we have to have the Corona bond instruments. The situation in the German Social Democrats is not like it was at the beginning of this decade at all. There's lots of support for Eurozone reform. So it feels like it's a matter of when and not if. But the big problem is that when needs to come soon enough for it to have an impact, because basically the bottom is falling out of the European and world economy. So the action needs to happen as soon as possible that we have, it's not even a fiscal stimulus, it's a rescue operation, economies on life support as the bare minimum needed to keep the show on the road.
It does feel existential. In the end, of course, if Italy gets through this without the help of others, this is back to our earlier conversation where Salvini may yet, as you know, Andrea said, let's not write him off too quickly. And let's also not forget that if Salvini gets a fillip after this, because he can say, where were you all? Top of his list is going to be leaving the EU.
Yeah, absolutely. The people that are able to come out of this crisis and benefit from it politically will be the people that sort it out and are seen by populations to have sorted it out. And that could favour the far right if progressives are seen to have failed, either on a national level or an international level. And of course, it could benefit progressives in a host of countries, and we could get sweeping reforms that we thought were extremely unlikely suddenly become, you know, really, really practical answers to the crisis.
I know I always say something like this, but I take quite a lot of hope from it, because I think people have really, there's something about the mood where people have really got bored or are absolutely sick of grandstanding governments. So I don't feel like people are taking Trump with the kind of, you know, gung-ho, he's a great guy feeling at all. I don't feel like that very, very superficial rabble-rousing politics is what anybody wants when you need a grown-up in charge. And maybe I'm wrong, but I just kind of feel like everybody wants a grown-up in charge, and that never benefits the far right.
I feel the sense of hope a lot, in the sense that I see people in Italy having this feeling that we are in the same boat, in a way, with all the other people that are also sick, that are also experiencing this tragedy. It was actually moving to see people in Italy singing at 6 p.m. every day Italian songs at the balcony all together. There was this sense of belonging to a community which was resilient to the same tragedy.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Coronavirus Lockdown is a new series of podcasts from the Another Europe team, with support from Global Justice Now. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road, even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we ask our guests what their thoughts are on the new leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, and talk about how coronavirus might impact the Brexit process. Remember that? You can also support the organisation and podcast by leaving us a rating or review on your podcast platform. It does make a really big difference in our ability to reach new listeners. We'll be back very soon. See you then. And, of course, look after each other. So it's been completely overshadowed by the global crisis that we've been rightly giving our full attention to. But, you know, in the long run, in British politics, the change in leadership of the official opposition is a kind of newsworthy event that will affect things going forward. And how are we feeling about that? We've got fellow podcaster Ed Miliband is returning to the front bench. I think in his post-leadership incarnation, that will be a positive for the Labour team, right?
I really like Ed Miliband. Everybody was really obsessing about who was going to be Shadow Chancellor. And I don't know who briefed it, but the word went round that it was going to be Rachel Reeves. And I found that really deflating. Then when it wasn't her, I felt really delighted. Actually, I've sort of been wrong about her. She's gone on her own political journey over the past couple of years. And she's been doing some really interesting work on, you know, the actual kind of the real economy, the jobs that we now rely so heavily on, of course, and how we value them and how livable it is to do them. And so A, I was wrong about her. B, she isn't shadow chancellor anyway. C, the job she's actually got puts her kind of tracking Michael Gove, which I think is exactly the right place for her, because he's so full of bluster and bullshit, and she's so, you know, pedantic. I could just really see her taking him apart. So even though there are gaps, I would have preferred to see Clive Lewis in the shadow cabinet. I'm kind of delighted, all told.
I agree completely with Clive. I think for me, that's the biggest gap. If there is a gap that Clive Lewis isn't there, I'd have liked to see both him and Rachel Maskell, partly because that would reflect probably most closely my own politics, but also because I believe it's really important that, you know, Keir has made it very clear, and I believe him and I'm with him, that he wants to sort of unite the party. I think to do that, there needs to be a bridge out of the shadow cabinet to some of the parts of the party that are going to feel most bruised. And obviously that's probably, you know, some of our comrades on the left. And I think that if we'd had Becky and Rachel and Clive, that would have been a good solid bridge to another bit of the left. So I think for me, that's an omission. I also just think that they're both very talented. Pleased to see Ed Miliband in there. He's committed, passionate, very knowledgeable. I think he'll do a good job. Also pleased to see Johnny Reynolds, actually, at DWP. He's very interested in UBI. I think he's very serious. He worked hard and well for John McDonnell. I think Becky Long Bailey is going to be great in education. I think she's going to have the confidence of the teaching unions. She's unequivocal in terms of, you know, her commitment to investment in further education, as well as, you know, abolishing tuition fees. So I think that's a really good and important appointment in an area that lots of people, you know, lots of activists in particular, are very interested in. I'm pleased to see Marcia de Cordova in there, actually, as well. Yeah, I mean, on balance, okay. I'll be diplomatic in not commenting on the ones that I wouldn't have put in air, but I probably disagree with one thing that Zoe said. It's very competent. There's a very serious statement of intent there about expertise and competence. Obviously, I'm pleased that Emily Thornberry has got a role, because I think she's a top-rate performer in Parliament, although, of course, at the moment, there's no Parliament for her to perform for.
Annalise Dodson, Shadow Chancellor. Great, great for Another Europe is Possible. She's a big friend of the campaign.
I forgot to say, actually, but obviously the most important appointment, I think that this is really, really good news. She's very serious. I listened to a rival podcast that she did the other day the social review, an hour-long interview, wide-ranging, a whole range of economic issues. She handles them all with expertise. She answers the questions. She's very knowledgeable. She's very thoughtful. So I think that's really great.
Andrea, are you free to comment on what anyone has said, but could I also ask you on the subject of the day, coronavirus, do you think the Labour Party as an institution has been more or less playing it right on the balance between, hey, we're sensible and responsible opposition, hey, we also need to scrutinise and attack the Tories?
Not quite. In my opinion, they should have called out the government much earlier during the initial response, which was completely contradicted by the following shift. So obviously it was wrong even by the government accounts, their initial policy. Of course, I understand that in a moment of a leadership contest in which there is not a clear voice for the party, it's difficult to attack the government on such an issue. However, it would have been nice to hear the leadership candidates to say something at that stage. This said, I am pleased that the first statement of Keir Starmer after the election was a responsible way to try to, not to attack the government, but to try to make a reasonable, measured critique of what they got wrong and what they should do now. I am also pleased that I see a lot of political sense in the balance that Keir Starmer has found in the cabinet, in the shadow cabinet. Of course, I'm very happy about Annalise Dodds. There is the right balance of continuity of the good things and discontinuity on some of the things that I didn't particularly like. And overall, there is a significant shift in terms of a more pro-European shadow cabinet, which is very good news. Also because, of course, this is going to be the major issue of the next couple of months, when hopefully we're going to get a grip on the epidemics and it's going to be better on the sanitary level. But, of course, what happens with Brexit is a big question mark. And my understanding is that until a very few days ago, the mindset of the government was to just go ahead with the plans without calling for an extension of the transition phase. I think the major task that Keir Starmer has is to build a coalition in parliament and in the country to change that policy and to extend the transition phase and to reset completely the UK Brexit policy.
Looking at Lisa Nandy, who's in favour of single market membership, and Annalise Dodds, who's a former MEP and in favour of single market membership, and Starmer during the leadership campaign himself made clear, with like Lisa Nandy did on several occasions, Labour should be supportive of single market membership. That should be the position. It basically means from these shadow cabinet appointments that there's a pretty clear lineup and categorical position here that Labour's going to argue for a soft Brexit, and if the Tories do go through with the very hard Brexit that they have in mind, Labour's going to oppose it, and that must be the right position, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and also you've got Emily as well, remember? Emily Thornberry, yep, doing trade. So, look, for me, that's probably one of the most important things in terms of the overall strategic political positioning. There are other areas where I think, you know, Keir has set out his 10 pledges. I believe he's an honourable man of his word. I think we have to now help him ensure that he can deliver on those. But certainly in terms of their international positioning vis-a-vis Europe, we're in a better place than we were before.
This is just a prediction. It's not what I hope is going to happen. It's not. I neither hope for it nor don't hope for it. But I genuinely think the situation is going to be so different when we come out of this that nobody will want to talk about something that might be expensive and complicated. So is this still a possibility that just everything just goes completely on ice? And I think that will be quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Tories will definitely extend the transitional period. One of the things that I think an argument we're going to hear from some people is that, oh no, Labour would never go into the next election promising to renegotiate the Tories' Brexit deal, right? We're going to anticipate that argument in the future. And I think that misunderstands completely what Brexit is, which is a constant series of negotiations with the European Union and with everyone else. So there's no such thing as a final deal. There's just permanent negotiations. So I think we should be prepared for that argument and swipe it aside as soon as we're ready to do so.
Yes, no, I completely agree with you, Luke. I would just add that the government locked the country down in a situation for which they need to pass a bill in parliament to to call for the extension of the transition phase and to change the approach towards EU.
I don't believe that it would be possible for the government to pursue a no trade deal exit from the transitional agreement, like the new no deal, right? Because they have basically, because of coronavirus, shut down large parts of the economy. And what they would be saying with the no trade deal exit is that we're going to shut down the other half, because customs trade is still going between Europe and the UK, right? I mean, you'd just be taking the most insane economic collapse that we're already experiencing, and then you would be giving it steroids to go into an even greater depression. You know, it's inevitable that the Tories will extend the transition period.
I completely agree with you, and it's sensible what you say. What I think is the government is not necessarily sensible. Then sense might come, because Boris Johnson is a bed in a hospital, you know. These are things that change your mind fundamentally if you get out of it. But at least in the beginning of the reaction to the crisis, I think there was an element, at least an element, of Brexit being the reason why there was a sense of denial that this crisis was deep enough to completely reset the discussion on any political issue. And there was a good article from Paul Mason on that on Social Europe a couple of days ago. So I hope that sense will come true. But I became more pessimistic with age, I think.
Well, we're out of time, folks. But thanks so much for talking to us from your respective locations.
Yeah, thanks so much. And we miss you, Laura.
Oh, thank you. And I miss all of you too, but I will come back at some point.
I suppose it's different, like, because we're currently in a state where we miss everyone.
Yes.
We have no... You may as well be in, like, Camden, exactly, for all I know.